Go ahead, we're now recording.
Thank you very much, Ricardo. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the locking of the domain name subject to UDRP proceedings PDP working group call. It's held on the 7th of February, 2013. On the call today, we have Juan Manuel Rojas, Alan Greenberg, Helge de Faller, Lisa Garano, David Rose-Kerner, Basil Shah, and David Maher. We have apologies from Cedar Lerman and Michaela Nalen. From staff, we have Marika Koenig, Barry Cobb, Lars Hoffman, and myself, Matthew Perrigan. And Gabriela Schlack has just joined the Adobe Connection. I would like to remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, Alan.
Thank you very much, Natalie, and welcome back formally. Our Michaeli has deserted us again today, so we're on our own. And as any updates to statements of interest? Hearing nothing, seeing nothing, we'll go on to the review of the work plan, and I'll go over to Marika for that.
Yeah, this is Marika. So basically, based on the call we had last week, I made some updates to the work plan to reflect that we missed our deadline of end of last year, and that we're now aiming to deliver the report by the publication deadline for Beijing, which is the 15th of March. So what I've done is basically listed the meetings that we have between now and that date, assuming that we're having weekly or continuing with our weekly meetings. So I've assumed that we may spend the next three or four meetings on reviewing the straw man and finalizing that. But assuming as well that hopefully in parallel people will start reviewing the first draft of the initial report that I circulated earlier this week. And that leaves us then two meetings basically to finalize the report by basically inserting the straw man recommendations and making any edits that may be necessary based on the recommendations we're making in other sections of the report, which would then hopefully get us to the 15th of March for publication. And then it's also assuming that on the 21st of March, we may have a meeting to actually prepare for the Beijing session. And there is also an option to not have another meeting on the 28th of March if needed, if there is anything further that needs to be discussed or prepared. Then it's also foreseen that we'll have a meeting during the ICANN meeting, which I think is probably going to be a more workshop format where we're presenting the report to the community and hopefully are able to get some input or be able to answer questions and encourage community members to actually provide input on the report as part of the public comment forum. And then the proposal would be that we actually open the public comment forum at the moment of publication, so the 15th of March, but actually let it running further through to the 3rd of May, so people have as well sufficient time after the meeting to submit their contributions. But again, of course, that's flexible. If more time is needed there, we can always change that. And then we would basically restart again on the 9th of May. We're starting to look at the comments received and work towards a final report. And I guess at that date, once we have an idea of the number of comments received and how much work we believe is remaining, we can then update the work plan to set ourselves a timeline for delivering a final report.
Thank you, Marika. It strikes me that the timing to get the initial report out and finalized by the 15th is tight, but as I think I said last time, I think we need to get something out regardless of how complete or incomplete it is, identifying the parts that we're still working on, because typically we want a public meeting where we at least understand the direction of where we're going, and to wait for the next one after Beijing I think is just far too long. So I certainly think that the work plan you've provided here, you're presented here, is something that we need to try to keep to. Anyone else have any thoughts on this? Not
Hello?
Hearing anyone, seeing anyone. Let's take it as a given, and we'll keep an eye on it as we're going forward over the next few weeks. It does mean we can't really afford. It does really mean we can't afford to miss any meetings. So we need to keep plotting forward. All right. Thank you. If we could replace the work plan with the straw man or the comments. I'm not sure which you want to go with first, Marika.
Alan, actually, first on the agenda, the initial report, just to briefly explain to people what...
Oh, I'm sorry. please go ahead.
And this is Rick, just to note that I quickly checked with our IT support there, and he's suggesting, because apparently some people on PCs getting an error message when they open the document, and he's wondering whether it may have something to do with the recent upgrade of Office, that it may want you to convert the document to the latest version of Word, and that's why it's giving the error message. But we're looking into that. So on the screen, you'll see the first draft of the initial report, and basically follows the model that some of you will have seen from other working groups that we've done. So basically, there are some elements that I've tried to complete as much as possible, but there are some parts that will need to be completed as we get further through our recommendations. And for example, you know, start off in an executive summary, which, of course, I haven't been able to complete yet, as that will be done as one of the last tasks once we have the report finalized or almost finalized. So it talks a bit about the background, and I think there it would be really helpful if members can have a look at that section. And in other efforts, it's usually more a summary of what is already contained in the issue report, because that's normally the place where the issue is outlined and all the information is gathered. But in this case, as there was no issue report specifically on this particular issue, but it was more on the broader UDRP, there isn't much information already published. So what I did, I basically gathered some of the information based on the discussions we've had and some of the email threads that we had in the beginning of our working group efforts. But I think I'm sure there are others that can add more detail to this or more background to it. It's basically trying to explain what are the issues that are being encountered with the locking of a domain name, and you know, basically explaining it in more detail as a background to the work that we've undertaken to do. And then the next section basically is just an overview of the membership, and we'll complete here as well to indicate the membership attendance, how that gives a bit of an idea of how many people participated and what level and how the representation was from the different groups. And then section 5 basically goes into the deliberations of the working group. So what I've done is basically, as a first step, outline or provide an overview of the survey we conducted. As you may recall, we did that in the beginning, and from that we took some findings that are reported here. And then for each of the charter questions, I basically try to outline what is the current situation, relying on some of the facts and figures we got from the survey and as well other information. And I'm basically moving towards working group findings for each of these charter questions, which basically most of them flow from the discussions we've had on the public comment forum. And also will eventually maybe need to be updated depending on where we end up with our recommendations. So again, there, if you feel anything is misstated there or anything is missing, you know, please feel free to edit or provide any suggestions that you may have. And section 6 is basically reserved for the preliminary working group recommendations. So the idea is that once we finalize our work on the straw man proposal, we actually are able to insert that here. One of the things we'll need to do as well is to assess the level of consensus for the recommendations, either as a package or on an individual level. And the working group is also expected to indicate the expected impact of the proposed recommendations. Again, that may be in a more general way, saying, well, we expect that, of course, this will have significant implications on, you know, how registrars, for example, deal with UDRP cases, or you know, will have an impact on UDRP providers' complainants, but basically trying to assess what the impact may be. And again, this is also an area where, you know, you may want to ask for input from others as part of the public comment forum, so that it can be incorporated as part of the final report. Then 7 basically just outlines the community input we've received, so it reflects the public comment period we've done and the outreach we've done to some of the groups to get input on this. 8 is basically just a placeholder for now, basically more for the final report. And then basically there's some annexes, like there's a working group charter, I think there's some of the templates that are there. And again, if there's other information that people feel should be added, you know, please let me know. So this document has now been posted on the wiki, so feel free to, you know, redline or send suggestions or edits by email, and we can work our way through the different drafts and hopefully eventually get to our final initial report by the deadline we've set ourselves.
Thank you, Marika. One thing I'd like to highlight is we being the GNSO, is continually reminded that the reports we put out are long and overwhelming, and that tends to mean that fewer people actually read them. So as people are reviewing it, I guess I would ask you to keep an eye out for things that are in the body of the report that where it wouldn't impact the report greatly to move them into an annex. Understanding that people may not read them, but that may increase the number of people who focus on the report altogether. So I think that's a general tendency we're trying to work on, and we've already done it with some of the items here, but something to keep in mind as you're reading it. David, I just saw you put a long comment into the chat. Do you want to say something on that?
Sure. It's not intended to be overly lengthy. I just thought I'd put it into the chat so we didn't lose track of it. It's just a very small factual observation on what looks to be an otherwise really excellent start to the draft report with many thanks to Marika and others involved for pulling that together. And it's just a factual comment to note on one of the pages which I've mentioned in the chat that WIPO, in fact, requires complainants to copy us as a UDRP provider on submitted complaints, to copy the registrar on submitted complaints, and just if we could note that in the report, I think it would help to round it out in terms of factual accuracy.
Okay, thank you. Any other thoughts or comments on the report before we go back to the prime part of our work? No comments? Then, Marika, thank you very much. It is a good start, and I do suggest that people find the time to at least scan over it. And, perhaps we'll devote a couple of minutes till every meeting just to getting any input so Marika can try to keep it moving in a good direction as we go forward on the policy itself. Hearing nothing else, seeing nothing else, let's go on to back to the straw man and comments. And Marika, do you want to remind us where we are?
Yeah, this is Marika. I don't know if you want to go back, because basically the latest changes that were made based on our discussions last week are in draft recommendation 2. And it's just unfortunate that I think some of the people that were very vocal about this issue are not on the call today. I think we had quite lengthy discussions between Volker and Christine about this point, so it would be really good to get their input on that. So I don't know if you want to pause on that now or move actually on to some of the other changes. Because basically, just to explain, in draft recommendation 2, what we inserted there is a provision to actually foresee when they're accredited privacy and proxy providers that there may be additional time or an option for the registrar to contact them to allow for the reveal of underlying registrant data. And basically to clarify that, if such contact is made, that there should already be a log, but that changes may be allowed, but only in the case where there's indeed an accreditation program in place. So I've drafted some language to that end, and basically it's there for people to review and comment on.
Yeah, I'm not 100% sure how we want to present that, whether we want to present it as integral part of the recommendation or sort of have a two-column with accreditation, without accreditation. To make it clear what we're talking about under the current scheme and what may happen in the future. But that's a formatting issue, and I think we can address that a little bit later in the process. I think it's a good idea, given that the main participants, perhaps other than me, who contributed to this are not here, that maybe we want to defer this till the next meeting and go back into the bulk of the document.
Right, so this is Marika. So then in draft recommendation 3, I made there the updates to change 1 day to 2 day. Also, 2 days, also something we discussed at the last meeting. And also something that was suggested in the last meeting is to clarify that pendency would be from the receipt of a request for verification through the remaining pendency to make sure that there's no confusion over the fact that, of course, the registrar doesn't, if pendency is from the start of the filing of a request, the registrar cannot have any awareness of that because they haven't been notified at that stage. It's just a clarification there.
Good.
Then scrolling down to the document, the next comment I see is from Luke in relation to draft recommendation 5. The recommendation currently reads, if deemed compliant, the UDFP provider shall forward the complaint to the registrar and the respondent and notify them of the commencement of the administrative proceedings within 3 calendar days following receipt of the fees paid by the complainant. And Luke basically says, this chronology looks like a call for abuse of the UDFP system. The locking of the domain name should be contingent upon settlement of the provider fee.
Give people a moment to read it over. And Luke is not on the call today.
No, Luke sent his apologies. It was a note in the start, but he did send his apologies in for this meeting.
I'm having trouble parsing this. It sounds like Recommendation 5 says it should be done within 3 calendar days following receipt of the fees, and then Luke is saying it should be contingent on settlement of the provider fee. I'm not sure I understand the difference.
This is Marika. I'm wondering if he's read that, and I don't know either if that was the intent or not, and maybe David can clarify there. If as a currently reach, you could also interpret it saying that the complaint is already forwarded to the registrar and the respondent if deemed compliant, but then actually it may be at a later stage that they're actually notified of the commencement of the administrative proceedings, which may be later if the fees haven't been paid yet. I don't know if that is how he read it or if that's actually the intention of the way it's worded now, but I'm also a bit confused about how it's written, but I'm wondering if that is maybe how he read it and that's why he's wondering whether that leaves it open for abusing the system.
I would suggest we defer this one until Luke gets back, because
I just have an observation. This is
go ahead.
From WIPO, which is just that the way this usually works for us is that the complaint is submitted, and in the complaint, the complainant makes a sworn declaration that payment's been made and that payment is in the process of being processed, and there's a number of ways in which that payment might occur. It might occur by credit card, for example, which is almost instantaneous. It might occur by way of check, which has to make its way halfway around the world. So there can be a period of days between the submission of the declared certified complaint and the actual receipt of the payment. From a provider perspective, if we receive a complaint where there are reasonable grounds to assume that the payment hasn't or is not going to be forthcoming, for example, because the complaint's not appropriately verified or there's been some problem with the complainant failing to pay or having been found to have abused the system previously, and we deem it necessary to wait for actual received confirmation of that payment, we'll do that at first instance. But the number of cases in which we find a complainant declaring and undertaking to pay and actually not doing that subsequently is infinitesimal.
All right. So what you're saying is you normally do not wait, as Recommendation 5 says, for the receipt of the payments from the complainant.
It depends on the form of the payment, and it depends on the specifics of the complaint. Our general approach is to rely on a declaration of payment by the complainant.
Okay.
And some indication that payment has been forthcoming. So, for example, in the case of a credit card payment, as I say, it's very, very quick. We are in a position to be able to very, very quickly clarify that the payment has been made and it's been received. In the case of a check, we might have to look at a copy of a photo stat, or we might have to see some form of evidence short of actual receipt of the payment itself. In the vast majority of cases, we have the cash in our account before we would proceed with the dispute, but there are some cases where there might be a delay of some days before we would receive actual confirmation of the payment. And in those cases, unless there's some reasonable basis to suspect that there's going to be a problem with the payment, we would proceed to issue the request.
So the recommendation really should allow you the discretion to wait for payment or wait for, I don't know what the words we're going to put there are, but essentially wait for a confidence level that the payment will be made at your discretion.
I think that would reflect the reality.
Yeah. Marika, do you have any feeling on how we could word that? Or David, do you have any suggestions?
Yeah, this is Marika. I think it would be really helpful if David or Christine can suggest wording if they feel that this what is currently there doesn't allow for that flexibility or reflect current practice.
All right, we'll try to come up with some wording, and hopefully by next week, either I'll dream something up or Marika, you make something up and have them criticize it. If you don't get anything from one of us, then just put something in as a placeholder, either some draft words or just something in parentheses reminding us that we need to what we need to do. And Luke, of course, when he gets back, can confirm that's what he actually meant or not.
Alan, just to confirm, I'm not sure that from my perspective, this is David, sorry, there's necessarily a problem with draft recommendation 5. I think the language in that recommendation essentially reflects the language that's already contained in the rules. My observations were more directed towards addressing the comment that Luke makes here suggesting that there might be a problem for abuse. Whereas I don't think that the incidence or likelihood of abuse, at least in our observation, is there.
Okay, how about if we simply say no later than 3 days following receipt? That allows you to do it earlier if you have a high confidence level and wait that long if necessary. Does that reflect reality? So we're mapping to reality, and it doesn't really change the wording much or the intent at all.
I think this is David. This is either formulation would be reasonable in my view.
Okay. All right, Marika, you've got marching orders.
Yep, I got that. Marika, you want to move on to the next one?
Yes, please.
So draft recommendation 6, if I recall well, I think this is language that was suggested by Christine based on discussions we had quite a while ago, but I think in the last few meetings we actually didn't go get that far into the recommendation. So draft recommendation 6, which currently reads, if the complaint should remain non-compliant or fees unpaid after the period for the administrative deficiency check per UDRP paragraph 4 has passed, or if the complaint should voluntarily, or if the complaint should voluntarily withdraw during that period, the UDRP provider informs the registrar that the proceeding is withdrawn. The registrar shall, within one business day of the transmission of the notice of withdrawal, release the lock. And one comment I made there is that we still, I think, at the end of the process, need to define what we exactly mean with lock.
Yeah. I think in the middle of the paragraph it should be complainant instead of complaint. Other than that, it sounds good to me. I don't think complaints can withdraw themselves. Any other comments on number 6? I see no hands. Welcome back again, Gabriella.
Thank you. We are in 6.
We're just finishing 6. The only comment was mine saying the complaint in the middle of on the fourth line should probably be complainant. Other than that, and the fact that we need to eventually define what lock is, I think we're done with 6 unless there's any other comments. And I do recall that I had a homework assignment of defining what items are to be locked, and I haven't done that yet. Number 7, Marika.
This is Marika. Draft recommendation number 7 currently reads, as part of its notification to the registrant, the UDRP provider informs the registrant that any corrections to contact information are also required to be communicated to the UDRP provider as per UDRP Rule 5, number 2 and number 3. And I added our comment, which is, again, based on previous discussions, that we need to include an initial report. Part of the rationale for allowing WHOIS changes, corrections to content information in WHOIS are allowed, as it otherwise might contradict WHOIS accuracy policy. And I think it's something we addressed in one of our earlier recommendations as well. And then there's also a comment from Luke that says, WHOIS modifications at this stage often leads the complainant to leave the proxy privacy services provider as a co-defendant of the registrant. We have seen several UDRP decisions rendered in this fashion.
And, all right, David, perhaps you can give us some insight as to why that happens. Is it a matter of not believing that the new entity named is really the one who takes responsibility? What's the rationale if there has been a reveal to keep the proxy provider as one of the as named in the complaint?
This is David here. Well, there are a number of different scenarios that can play out where you see a privacy or a proxy registration service and the shield is lifted to reveal an underlying registrant. One of those is that the underlying registrant is revealed to the provider and is also revealed in the public WHOIS. There is another scenario that's common where the underlying registrant is revealed to the provider, but the privacy or proxy registration service remains visible in the public WHOIS. There are variations, let's say, between the two of those in scenarios where you have a number of different disputed domain names and the practice can differ depending on the registrar that's involved. So what usually happens in these situations at WIPO is that we then, having received the relevant information from the registrar, we go back to the complainant and we give the complainant an opportunity to amend their complaint. The complainant can either opt to modify its complaint to address it solely as against the underlying registrant, or it can nominate to address its complaint to both the disclosed underlying registrant and the privacy or proxy registration service as a co-respondent. And one of the reasons why a complainant might choose to retain both, for example, is that the UDRP includes a provision for a respondent who wishes to dispute the result of a UDRP process before a court to do that. And for that reason, the complainant has to nominate a jurisdiction that they would agree to submit to in the event that the respondent would dispute in court. And one of the options that the complainant has for that purpose is the location of the registrant, as it's listed in WHOIS at the filing of the complaint with the provider. And that sometimes is the privacy or the proxy registration service, and the privacy or the proxy registration service is located in a jurisdiction, and that may be the complainant's mutual jurisdiction election for the purposes of the proceeding. So sometimes a complainant elects to retain both the privacy or the proxy registration service and the underlying registrant. In that sort of scenario, we then proceed, in fact, in all of these cases, we'll proceed to notify the complaint to both the privacy and the proxy registration or privacy registration service and the underlying disclosed registrant, and usually the panel will then make a determination when it's appointed as to the identity of the respondent that the panel regards as appropriate. If the panel regards both the privacy or the proxy registration service and the disclosed underlying registrant as appropriate co-respondents, then we reflect both of those entities in the title of any decision that is then issued based on that panel determination. So, most of the cases, I suspect, at least from WIPO, where you're seeing both the privacy or the proxy registration service and the underlying registrant included in the issued decision as named co-respondents, is because that's the determination that's being made by the panel following their appointment.
Thank you, David. It never ceases to surprise me when I ask what I think is a simple question and get a very long answer indicating the process. The issue is far more complex than I imagined when I asked the question. If I can summarize, I think what you're saying, it is to a large extent at the discretion of the complainant whether both are remain named or not?
I think there are principally two parties that exercise discretion in this scenario. The first is the complainant, because they determine the parties named in their complaint based on the information that we forward to them from the registrar. And the second is the decision maker, the panel, that needs to make a ruling in due course. The root of the problem, Alan, I think, is that the UDRP was never designed to deal with privacy or proxy registration services. So it's not well equipped to provide us with clarity.
Right.
It's an issue which panels have had to wrestle with, I think, through their decisions a lot of the time, and which providers and parties have had to feel their way on. And that's why I think it often sounds complicated, because I think, as you say, it is quite difficult. And I think, you know, any additional clarity that we can add to that scenario as part of this process can only help.
Okay. So, but effectively, until it goes to the panel, it's the complainant who makes the choice whether to accept the new registrant information or keep them both.
That's right. And
okay.
That's right. And I will just clarify there, as I mentioned earlier, that in any event, the provider, and I believe this is also the case at NAF, the provider will notify the complaint both to the privacy or the proxy
right.
registration service and to the underlying registrant. And the reason for doing that is precisely to keep alive the panel's discretion to make a necessary determination without having to require the whole re-notification of the proceeding if the panel determines that it's one or the other and they haven't received a copy.
Exactly, yeah. So I think the answer to Luke is yes, and it's going to keep on happening at least until we have accreditation of privacy and proxy services, and one can put a high degree of trust in the fact that the reveal is indeed a true reveal and will be acted on properly. And
I agree with that, Alan. This is David again. And I would also add that I think that there are implications that flow from the question of the mutual jurisdiction election that I mentioned earlier. And I'm sorry if this sometimes comes across as a little bit complicated, but there are implications that flow from that because the complainant, as things currently stand, essentially is opting for a mutual jurisdiction election, which the rules define as relating to the identity of the registrant as it exists in the WHOIS at the time that the complaint is filed. And I think we need to keep coming back to that, because when we're thinking about privacy and proxy registration services, we also need to be thinking about them in terms of what it means both for complainant's ability to make a mutual jurisdiction declaration with certainty and what it also means for respondents in terms of their ability to take the matter to a jurisdiction which for them is convenient and consistent with the language of the policy as it currently exists. And there's a particularly concrete reason I mention that, which is that in draft recommendation 3, for example, there's some words in there currently in the latter part of the first paragraph, which I think we should consider maybe putting some square brackets around for the moment, which is where it says, for the purposes of the UDRP, the registrant listed in the WHOIS record at the time of the lock will be recorded as the respondent. And the difficulty there potentially is that risks inconsistency, I think, with the language of the policy itself in some ways, at least to the extent that the policy says that the relevant mutual jurisdiction option that's available to the complainant is the identity of the registered domain name holder as it exists in the WHOIS at the filing of the complaint. So we may be making a recommendation here that sits very uncomfortably with the way that the policy, and in particular the mutual jurisdiction aspects of the policy, work currently.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'm going to say thank you for adding that level of not confusion, but difficulty in how this is going to play out. It strikes me, though, as you're talking, that you've given us an excellent reason why we perhaps in our recommendation should, our overall recommendations should not focus on what happens when there are accredited privacy and proxy services, because it's quite clear that part of the creating an accreditation program is going to be looking at the UDRP with a fine-tooth comb to catch all of the places where the process may change because of the concept of privacy proxy services, and particularly proxy services where the identity of the base registrant is masked. And so I'm starting to wonder, should we put anything in at all about that world? Because I think it's going to require a significant amount of effort, but can only be done once the basics of the accreditation program are understood and locked down.
This is David. Alan, I agree with that. I think it's very difficult to have a discussion about such a wide-ranging and complex topic in circumstances in which we don't yet have the benefit of recommendations about how privacy and proxy registration services are going to be accredited and regulated more generally. I think we've made very steady progress in this group technically on working towards ways to clarify the way that the lock obligation works in a conventional UDRP proceeding without privacy and proxy registration services, precisely because we understand how well that framework currently operates. I think it's a very different scenario when we get into privacy and proxy registration services, particularly because we have to do that while also speculating about how they may be regulated in future.
Yeah, for the future of whoever has to do that work, we may want to create a set of notes of issues where we believe things may change, and maybe even suggestions of the direction how they change, but I don't think it could be part of our formal recommendations for the implementation. I welcome Volker onto the call, and Marika, do we perhaps now want to go back to number two? Because Volker was one of the participants. We still don't have Christine, but maybe we can get at least Volker's take on whether two addresses the kinds of issues he was talking about.
Marika? So, yeah, this is Marika. So, Volker, I don't know if you had a chance to look at the language that I've drafted for recommendation two that tries to address the discussion we had at the last meeting to have this kind of two-step approach once they're accredited privacy and proxy services in place, whereby the registrar at that point in time would be able to go back to the privacy proxy provider and notify them of the fact that the UDRP complaint has been filed, and at that moment a reveal can be done if agreed to. So basically I've written a paragraph that tries to reflect what we discussed last week, and it's just to check if that fits with your views, and also we hope to get feedback as well from Christine, who was involved in that discussion on addressing and framing that issue correctly.
Yeah, it's Alan. Before we go to Volker, I'll note that at least the lead-in of this paragraph is talking about the situation where there are accredited privacy proxy providers. So this is the kind of thing that we may want to put into the adjunct comments, not the recommendation itself. Volker?
Yeah, that makes sense because the program is not there yet, and I have the feeling that at least part of ICANN is reluctant to start that process, at least after yesterday's RIA negotiations. Putting that in the recommendation at this time might be a bit premature. I agree with that. But basically, the language looks fine.
All right. That's an interesting and disturbing comment you made. In light of the way our deliberations are going, it's quite clear that until the issue of accreditation for privacy proxy services is settled, the UDRP is always going to have a level of fuzziness and confusion that is not a good thing. So,
I completely agree.
Let's hope you're right. You're wrong. Okay, let's, Marika. I'm not quite sure how we're going to format that. You know, putting at the side the accreditation issues, but I think we'll have to, before we finalize these recommendations in the next couple of weeks, we'll have to come to some closure on that. And let's go back to wherever we were.
Yeah, doesn't work. If I could just make a comment on the accreditation recommendation. Personally, I think there are two options. Either, indeed, you just make it as a suggestion and saying once that PDP kicks off, because as I understand, it will need to go through a PDP, or at least it's the latest I know of that, that working group would consider that specific question and consider what this group has already discussed on it. Or, indeed, you just build it in as a recommendation. And, you know, it's, of course, clear that at this stage there are no accredited privacy proxy provider, so that specific provision would not apply. But you can say, well, we're already building it in, and if the follow-up effort can take note of what we've done and what we've suggested, of course they have an opportunity then to either rewrite it or change it. I think there are two ways you can basically deal with that.
Yeah, whether the accreditation concept needs to go through a PDP is not crystal clear. It is, however, clear that the changes that may need to be made to the UDRP because of accreditation will need to go through a PDP. So whether it's all wrapped into one PDP or there's just a PDP to fix the UDRP because the other parts have been agreed to, this part will have to fall on a PDP since we're modifying an existing consensus policy. At least that's my reading of it. Volker, go ahead.
Just one minor comment. If we want to take out the proxy provider's reference, I would suggest replacing that with proxy privacy provider affiliated with the registrar or something like that, because in that case we would still want to be able to replace the data.
Okay, that's a good one, and that's I suspect the large majority of registrations using proxy are indeed like that. I don't know the statistics, but I wouldn't be surprised. So adding clarity to those cases, I think will help significantly. Good idea.
I think we could then reference that in our comments outside the recommendation and say that if ever an accreditation program for those providers, third-party providers, comes into place, the same would apply to could be applied to them if so decided in the accreditation PDP.
Good, that's a good contribution. Good contribution, okay. Thank you. Okay, back to where were we? 6, 7?
9. 9. Yeah,
this is
because on the previous one, I think on 8. Finished that, and on 8 there were...
Right.
So draft recommendation number 9, I think this is language that was initially started by me and then modified by Christine based on earlier discussion. So the recommendation currently reads, upon receipt of a decision from the provider, the registrar must within 3 calendar days communicate to each party, the provider and ICANN, the date for the implementation of the decision in accordance with the policy, UDRP Rule 16 and UDRP Paragraphs 4K and Paragraphs 8A. If the complainant has prevailed, the registrar shall implement the panel order immediately after 10 business days have elapsed, UDRP Paragraph 4K. The complainant is responsible for providing the registrar with the required information regarding implementation. This may include the information that should be in the WHOIS. If the respondent has prevailed, the registrar shall prohibit transfer of the domain name to another registrar or registrant for 15 days from the date the decision is transmitted from the UDRP provider, UDRP paragraph 8. And there are 3 comments here from Luke. The first one is, why does it fall under the registrar purview? Can the UDRP provider do the math? And I think this relates to the first part. And then he has a comment as well in relation to after 10 business days have elapsed. He said there, do we need to add here that this delay has been set up for the defendant to lodge an appeal before a competent court of law, or is that too obvious? And then he also has a comment regarding the responsible for providing the registrar with the required information. He says there, we should add that obligation as a best practice, if not a mandatory requirement for the unlocking of the domain name.
Thank you, and we have several hands up. Volker.
Yes, thank you. Volker Greimer speaking. Just a question, if this notification by the registrar is really necessary within 3 calendar days. Normal way we handle it currently is that we know that the provider will inform the complainant and the registrar and the defendant respondent to the, about the result of the case. So after we receive this, we will inform within usually 3 business days. The complainant, if he has one, how he can transfer and when he can transfer. And in case of the respondent losing, we remove the locks. So the respondent winning, we remove the locks. So I'm not quite sure why we need a 3 calendar day communication from the registrar for something that is already being communicated by the provider.
And I can't add any insight because I don't understand either. David.
Yeah, just a couple of points of clarification. One is just in response to Luke's first comment, although he's not in on the call, why does this fall under the purview of the registrar? I think there are probably 2 reasons for that principally. One is that it's the registrar that actually needs to implement the decision, and the provider, of course, can't do this themselves. And the other, I think, is that because the provisions in the UDRP require implementation within business days, it's the registrar that's, of course, best placed to calculate the business days that are applicable in that relevant jurisdiction. That's just an observation. The other is just a comment on the language in Draft Recommendation 9, which says that upon the receipt of a decision from the provider, the registrar must, within 3 calendar days, communicate to each party, the provider and ICANN, the date for implementation. I think the way that the policy reads, at least currently, the rules, is that the provider needs to communicate to the registrar and the parties the decision within 3 calendar days, and the registrar is then, at least according to the rules, supposed to immediately communicate the relevant date for implementation 10 business days thereafter. So it's just a factual point. I'm not sure if the point of the recommendation is to reflect the current language of the rules or to suggest some change to them. But as it reads currently, it's not consistent in that way with the way that the rules operate at the moment.
And how would you suggest changing it? Now that I read it carefully, I realize that what the registrar is providing is not information about the decision, but telling the parties the date that it will be implemented, which I didn't catch, to be honest, on my first reading. I'm not also quite sure why it's 3 calendar days there instead of perhaps 1 business day.
This is David. I think it depends whether what we're doing here is making a recommendation to change the rules and the policy, or whether we're proposing a recommendation that's consistent with the rules and the policy. If the objective is the latter, my suggestion would be to change the language so that it reads, upon receipt of a decision from the provider, the registrar must directly communicate to each party, the provider and ICANN, the date for implementation of the decision, because that's the requirement that exists under the policy and rules. If we're making a recommendation that the policy and rules, or the rules in particular, paragraph 16, be changed, then I suppose we should say that.
Okay, we have Marika. David, I assume that was your old hand, Marika, and Volker next.
Yeah, this is Marika. I think one of the things that may help here then is actually to define what directly means. And I don't know if indeed that Christine tried to attempt to say that 3 days is immediately or directly, because I think that's one of the things we're trying to do in this effort, to really make clear and as well make sure that ICANN compliance can enforce what needs to be done. Because, you know, if we say directly, some might say, well, directly for me is within a week. Others might say directly for me is in 1 day. So I think if we can clarify what we mean, try to interpret what directly means for us, I think that may be helpful.
That certainly makes sense, because what we're trying to do is add clarity specifically for registrars who may not do this on a very regular basis. Volker.
Yes, I'm just concerned that I'm giving compliance another tool to shoot myself in the foot with by defining a period that we may not be able to meet. For example, if we receive a the decision on December 23rd, then there's no way that we'll be able to, maybe even by close of business of that day, we might not be able to do it because there's three holidays afterwards, maybe even more. So business days, two business days, maybe as a compromise, might be more applicable than three calendar days because it takes into account business practices of different registrars. It should also be enough because even if the complainant receives the information of how to transfer the domain name and when to transfer the domain name one day prior to his ability to do so, then he's still able to transfer at the 10th day. And finally, we've seen a lot of cases where even though we communicated this right away when we received the information from the provider, we've seen cases where the lawyer of the complainant doesn't respond for half a year to transfer the domain name, and we have to run after them or something. So I think three calendar days is a bit too unwieldy to for most registrars, and it would be better to have it, a timeline that is in accordance to business practices, so business days, maybe even two. Shorten it, but make it business days. That's essentially what I'm asking.
It's Alan. I tend to support that. I do worry, and Volker, maybe you have some thoughts on this. What happens if we have a registrar who says, I close down from Christmas to New Year's, and the first business day after the 23rd is the 3rd of January? Do we need to worry about that kind of scenario, or do you believe that that's, and I guess I'm asking David also.
Well, we could define business days as days of national holidays, not days where the registrar closes down, so that might be one way. And I'm not sure, I don't have the policy in front of me, but how many days do you have for implementation? Is it calendar day, 10 calendar days or business days?
I'll turn to David on that.
I'm sorry, what was the question again, Volko?
How many days does after how many days can the decision to transfer be implemented? Is it 10 business days or 10 calendar days?
10 business days.
So that wouldn't, even if the registrar went on a holiday for a week, which I know a couple of Japanese registrars do, that would just push back the day of implementation by that much. And being informed later because of changing it to business days would not put the registrar in a situation or the complainant in a situation where he would be able to transfer at a later day. I don't think it's going to be a problem.
Okay. I tend to like your idea that somewhere we may want to define business days and not make it totally the discretion of the registrar. So maybe that's something we can come back to as after we go through all of this. I think in general we have moved away from calendar days, especially when the number of days is small, because of the kind of situation you're talking about.
This is David. I don't have an especially strong view on the issue, but I'm just querying that we're comfortable that we've got coverage under the mandate to make recommendations on adjustment to implementation date in the context of this particular working group.
I'm just asking, okay. if the policy as it is states business days, then... Yeah, I understand that if we define business days, that might be going beyond our scope, but defining business days as well for the response time of the registrar or the information time of the registrar should be a no problem. Would that be agreed?
If we're talking about something in relation to when is something locked or unlocked, it is within our domain.
But how does when the registrar notifies the date on which the decision would be implemented connect to the question of lock? I'm not saying it doesn't. I just wonder where that connection would lie.
Well, if the decision is to transfer, then clearly the domain remains locked until it's transferred. So... I think it's still within our scope. The registrar can't unlock it with the current registrant if the provider has ordered a transfer, unless I'm missing something. Marika, any thoughts? Are we in an issue of mission creep, or do you feel comfortable?
Well, this is Marika. As I said, you know, if there's a term directly and there's agreement here in the group that directly means within 3 business days, I'm not really sure if there's a big issue. Of course, if people really object and say it should be calendar days or we shouldn't touch it, I think it's something else. But I think I hear people saying that at least the 3 business days is considered reasonable and doesn't change the rules. It just interprets what directly means.
Yeah. No, I feel comfortable we're not creeping. But, you know, if using the term business days adds a level of uncomfortability to anyone except me, then I think it is reasonable that we define that along the way. But
this is David. Where I hit discomfort is if we start talking about making an adjustment to the actual date of implementation itself. I think the question of when within a day or two the registrar notifies the parties about when the decision is going to be implemented is one thing, and maybe it's good to have a conversation about that so that it better reflects current business realities. But where I think we shouldn't tread lightly, at least, is into the question of when the decision itself should be implemented in accordance with the language of the policy, where we've got a fair degree of clarity on that currently. And I mean, I'm not sure that we need to be discussing that question.
Yeah, I don't think we are suggesting that be changed. I don't think. I've lost track of exactly what the new words are. But I think that 10 business days there was just reaffirming what is in the policy right now. And I don't think we have a problem. David, is that a new hand or just the...
Oh, I'm sorry. What was it? A vestigial hand.
Yes. I don't think vestigial is actually the right word in this case, but nevertheless.
Redundant, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Purple.
All right. Where are we going now? Marika, do you feel comfortable with where...
Yes, but
okay.
This is just to know that we've actually passed the top of the hour, so I don't know if you want to continue further or...
It's just such a fascinating discussion, and I never thought I would say that. All right, then I would say that you are right. We are past the hour, and I have another meeting not very long from now. So I will thank you all, and we will continue... with number 10, I think. And please take the time to at least start glancing over the draft report, and let's give feedback to Marika on that. Thank you all.
Thank you as well.
Thanks,
thank
everybody.
You. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Ricardo. You may now stop the